So when I left off last time, I had this equation on the board. We had computed at least parametrically. The detectability of the three-point function in single-field inflation. The three-point function is detectable if the number of modes observed in, say, the CMB or some other probe is larger than the signal-to-noise ratio per mode, which parametrically is the amplitude of the fluctuations themselves, a small number, further suppressed by slow roll parameters. It's interesting to do the same forecast for the other three-point functions, such as the correlator of two scalars and a gamma and a graviton. So in Matusenyi's paper, so I might ask, if gravity waves are detected, maybe the next step could be to search for their non-Gaussianity, either by three-point correlating the gravity waves or correlating them with scalars. To forecast signal-to-noise for the zeta-zeta-gamma three-point function, for example, the denominator that you want to use, you want to split the denominator between the zeta and gamma power spectra. So the right denominator to use is one power of zeta zeta and one half power of gamma gamma. And so if we look in Matusenyi, the numerator here is h squared epsilon to the minus one. There's no eta in either three-point functions or power spectra involving gamma. Over, so this denominator is h cubed epsilon to the minus one. Each gamma gamma contributes in h squared. Each zeta zeta contributes in h squared over epsilon. And so this comes out to just be h or this combination. When we think about the microphysics of inflation, it's best to write things. It's usually easiest to write answers in terms of h and slow roll parameters. But when we think about observations, we usually want to convert the h's into delta zetas because that's what's observed. So this is actually a little bit better. It's got, instead of one power of slow roll, it's got a half power. Likewise, so that was, if we do the other cases, this guy, according to Matusenyi, is h to the fourth with no slow roll. Downstairs we have h cubed epsilon to the minus one half. So this gives, for gamma, 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 there's no epsilons at all. So the signal-to-noise looks a little bit larger, say, for this three-point function, where one way of thinking about this three-point function is that you're looking for the effect of a gravity wave on the small-scale statistics, the small-scale power spectrum of a scalar mode evolving in that gravity wave. The signal-to-noise looks a little bit better, but what we've actually forecasted here is the signal-to-noise, assuming that you get to measure many modes of the gravity waves, many modes of the gamma field. I don't see any way of doing that. We can they show up in B modes of the CMB, but we only get to see gravity wave B modes if they're there at all. We'll only see them over a relatively modest range of L. The way the B mode power spectrum looks, there's this rising foreground from gravitational lensing. And then the gravity waves show up as a couple of bumps and then damp out at high L. So since I don't personally see any way, the physical reason this happens, by the way, is that as soon as gravity waves, so the co-moving horizon is a decreasing function of time during inflation, but then an increasing function of time during radiation and matter domination. So a mode at a given wave number, is frozen outside the horizon, but then in the late universe, it re-enters the horizon and starts evolving. For the gravity wave, the way that evolution works out is that it's just exponentially suppressed if there are no new sources for the gravity wave, such as viscosity. If you have cosmic strings around or something, maybe. Anyway, so it's exp this is exponentially suppressed for a good reason. And so I don't see any way of measuring gravity waves over a wide range of scales, getting a large number of modes. And so I would say that this is actually our best shot at detecting the small level of non-Gaussianity from single field inflation, and it's pretty futuristic. You can also extend this analysis to higher point correlation functions. You can try to look for this sort of process, which is a 4-point, it would show up as a 4-point function, a non-Gaussian 4-point function in the scalar modes mediated by a gravity wave. All of these processes turn out to be small. So one can really construct sort of a proof, at least order by order in perturbation theory, that in single field inflation, the observed field is extremely close to a Gaussian field, the observed zeta field. Okay, so that's it for single field inflation. We're all now survivors of one of the most notoriously complicated calculational papers in cosmology. Now I'm going to talk about some models that do generate interesting deviations from Gaussian statistics. So I'm going to start with a warm-up model. So I like this. This is following Daniel Bauman's notes, which are linked on the wiki, and I mentioned on the first day. I should mention in advance that this model has some problems. It's not radiatively stable. It's not stable under loop corrections. And it's also not possible to crank up the level of non-Gaussianity to be arbitrarily large. So after we study it, we'll do another model, DBI inflation, which doesn't have those problems. But and so this will be very similar to DBI inflation, but I personally find it algebraically simpler and more intuitive to think about the physics. So I'm going to start with this. So another reference is this paper by Paolo Cramminelli, which I believe was the first paper to talk about this model. Here's the model. The motivation is that the motivation for considering this model is that this type of interaction term, suppressed by some mass scale lambda, is what you might expect to see first if inflation were some sort of effective field theory with corrections, ultraviolet corrections at some cutoff scale. By the way, the reason for not considering a simpler term here, like a phi to the fourth, is that this would already be included in the V of phi. Okay. So first, let's think about we're going to find a background solution and then expand in powers of the fluctuations around the background solution to study the two-point function and three-point function. First, let's think about the background solution. So, how would you find the equations of motion? So, the degrees of freedom here are a dynamical metric g mu nu and a scalar phi. How would you find the equations of motion around this background? For the background with this action. Okay, so let's vary it with respect to the metric first. So if I vary with respect to g, then the variation has a name. The stress energy tensor. So the definition of the stress energy tensor. The way it's usually defined is with my sign convention for the metric is like this. Here I'm freezing the field phi. If I vary with respect to the metric, then this equation defines the stress energy tensor. If I vary this piece by piece, first I'm going to need to vary the square root of minus g. There's a little formula here which always comes up that you've probably seen. This is a general formula for the variation of the determinant of a matrix or some power like the 1/2 power. When I vary the g, I get this piece. G lower mu nu times delta g mu nu. I vary the square root of minus g times what I had before. Plus a term where I vary what's in brackets. So what would be the variation of this first term with respect to g upper mu nu? This definition for the stress energy tensor is usually written in the books where you vary with respect to the inverse metric. You vary the inverse metric. You could write it as a formula where you vary the metric with lower components. You just have to be careful about the signs since this guy is minus, what you might think it would be. What is the variation of this first term here with respect to g upper mu nu?
In the product of covariant derivatives of p without a contraction. In the definition of the square.
Oh, I see. You're having. Oh, right. Okay. A comment that I could have made is that I think you could probably do this with covariant derivatives, but when you're varying with respect to g mu nu, it's easiest to use to keep everything in terms of ordinary partial derivatives, I think, because the covariant derivatives are hiding metric dependence.
They're acting on scalars, so they just become derivatives.
Yeah, exactly. The answer, this term is hiding. I think this is what you're saying. This term is hiding a factor of g upper mu nu. If I fix phi and vary with respect to g upper mu nu, I just get this. Down here, phi, upper mu nu. This guy isn't hiding anything except for the square root g, which we already differentiated. So it's delta g mu nu. This term isn't hiding anything, so its variation is zero. This term gives, so there are two. There are two factors of delta mu nu. I pull down a factor of two and then vary the other guy to get this. And now if I just read off, I can read off the coefficients of delta mu nu and find the stress energy tensor. Here's the stress energy tensor for this model. Okay.
He is square multiplying the product of those two derivatives.
Thanks. Okay. Now, to
finish driving the equation of motion for the metric, the general thing to do is I've done half the calculation. I've worked out the stress energy tensor. The next thing to do is to set this equal, work out the Einstein tensor, and set this equal to 8 pi g times the stress energy. Since I'm interested in a background which has translational and rotational symmetry, then I already know that the Einstein equations are going to be Friedmann's equations, some special case of Friedmann's equations, with the density and pressure read off from the stress energy tensor. In other words, the dynamical variables here will just be a scale factor A of t and the scalar field phi. So from the stress energy tensor, I read off, so rho is t 0, 0, which is 1 half phi dot squared plus v of phi. This is what I would have for single field sole inflation plus this. And P, the pressure from the diagonal space-like part, is this familiar piece from single field so roll plus 1 over 8 under to the fourth phi dot. Okay. So from these equations, I read off Friedmann's equation. That's one of the equations of motion, the equation of motion for the scale factor. Now, there's a second Friedmann equation that one could write down, but it's equivalent to. It's always equivalent to let's put you at the top. There's a second Friedmann equation, but it's always equivalent to the, or follows from some combination of the other equations of motion, and it's easier just to work out the equation of motion for phi directly. So I'm going to do this in the equation of motion for phi in a fixed metric. You can either do this with covariant or non-covariant derivatives. I'm going to use, either one will work. I'm going to use non-covariant derivatives since I think it turns out to be a little easier. So if I use non-covariant derivatives, then when I differentiate with respect to delta mu phi, I need to keep the square root minus g inside. If I were to use non-covariant derivatives, then I wouldn't have the square root of minus g, but then I would have covariant derivatives that encode the metric dependence in a different way. So it's easier, I found it easier to do it this way. Okay, so differentiating what's under the integral sign with respect to partial mu phi, including the square root minus g, I get this. I also need the square root of minus g here. Okay, now unpacking this a little bit. So generally speaking, when you have the symmetries of FRW, the rotation and translation invariants, only the time equation of motion here is relevant. The square root of minus g just converts to a cubed. And this is phi dot. Cubed. This is 1 over 2 lambda to the 4th a cubed phi dot squared phi dot. So cubed v prime. And then if you work this out, you get this. Let me just rewrite that without the a cubed prefactor. Okay. This is the equation of motion for phi. One way to think about this is that so what we have in the limit of large lambda, it's this equation of motion for that we had in single field slow roll inflation. One way to think about these new terms is that as the field starts rolling down the potential and picking up velocity, we get an increase in the friction term and also an increase in the mass. Now, I can't say this is a nonlinear, a very nonlinear differential equation. I don't think that I can make any intelligent general statement about what the solutions might look like for arbitrary weird potentials where the field can start rolling very fast. But we're interested in slow roll regimes where what slow roll means intuitively is that everything is changing slowly, doesn't change by much in a Hubble time, except for the scale factor itself, which exponentially increases. But everything else, like h, phi dot and so on, all change by a small amount in a Hubble time. And so I think, so I know of, for these two equations of motion, two interesting slow roll regimes. Well, one is just the limit where this cutoff lambda is large compared to the energy scale of inflation, in which case this is actually just the usual slow roll. This is just the case where I perturbed the action of slow roll single field inflation by a perturbation that was too small to have any interesting effects. So all of it, all of the observables, including the three-point functions, will be the same as what we already studied. The second interesting slow roll regime, so by sort of playing around, I arrived at the claim that this is also a slow roll regime. So I want The derivative of log v in Planck units to be order 1. So this was the parameter I called epsilon, or it's actually 2 epsilon to the 1 half, in single field slow roll. Now I want it to be order 1. By order 1, I really mean order 1. I don't want it to be either too large or too small. So I deliberately want to consider a potential that's steep. Its steepness is sort of order 1 in Planck units. The other assumptions in this regime that I want to consider, I'm going to assume that the second derivative, this was the other slow roll parameter in single field slow roll inflation, that has to be order 1 or less. It's okay if that's small. And finally, I want to assume that this cutoff is small compared to the energy scale of inflation, that there's some separation of scales here. And so I claim, I want to prove to you that this is a slow roll regime. So I claim that in this regime, under these assumptions, so number 2 here are the set of assumptions that I'm going to fix for the rest of the discussion of this model. So I claim that in this regime, the following slow roll approximations are valid. So you remember in single field slow roll, one nice property about the slow roll regime was that it allowed us to simplify the equations of motion by replacing them with differential equations of lower order. So here I claim that in the equation of motion for A, the dominant contribution to H is just the potential term, just like single field slow roll. But in the equation of motion for phi, it's the new funny friction term that dominates. So what's happening here physically is that you're living on a steep potential. Without the new interaction term, you wouldn't get inflation. You would just decrease the Hubble constant by an order 1 fraction each Hubble time and quickly roll down to the bottom of the hill. But this new friction term is dominating and making the inflaton roll slowly down the hill, even though the potential is steep. So to check that this is true, I need to verify. What I can do is pretend that I have integrated these simplified equations of motion to find A of t and phi of t. And then I want to verify that on that slow roll solution, the other terms that I neglected in the equations of motion are small. So I need to verify that all neglected terms in star and star star are small when evaluated on the slow roll solution. This is pretty mechanical. You can start by figuring out how large phi dot is. From this equation, you read off that phi dot. So if I take this equation and plug in the h, then I get b to the 1 half times m Planck phi dot cubed over lambda to the fourth is an order 1 number. On the right-hand side, one of my assumptions here is that the v prime is an order 1 number times v m Planck to the minus 1. So if you rearrange, you get that phi dot is an order 1 number times v to the 1 sixth lambda to the 4 thirds, this combination of the two scales in the problem. And then It's easy to see that, it's now easy to see that the missing terms in star are subleading. The terms that I neglected are these. And if I plug them in with this, if I plug in a find odd of this order and remember that lambda to the fourth over v is small, then you'll check right away that you get something which is much smaller than v. An important consequence is that the equation of state W is close to minus one. If the v is dominating the other terms in the stress energy tensor, p and so if you look at the expressions for rho and p here, if the v is dominating the other terms in the stress energy tensor, then p over rho is very close to minus one. So this is an important property of an inflationary spacetime. It means that the Hubble constant isn't changing much in Hubble time. And a similar analysis works for man, I have some sort of mental block against proficiency with these boards. So a similar analysis works for phi double dot. If you just, I'll leave out the details because they're kind of mechanical. If you differentiate this equation, I'll just say, and then rearrange to get an expression for phi double dot, you can work out the parametric order of phi double dot, which turns out to be, phi double dot turns out to be of order, b to the 1/3, lambda to the 8/3, and Planck minus one or smaller. V double prime will appear here, but I have an assumption on how large that is. And then plug in the equation of motion for phi, you'll see that the various terms that this term in front that I neglected is smaller than the v prime. I guess I also neglected the one here. You'll see that that's also smaller than v prime. So I'll leave those steps out and just say that star star can be checked. Okay. Oh, by the way, it'll also be useful to define. So now that we know that this is sort of a slow roll, and under these assumptions, we get sort of a slow roll inflationary type background, it'll be useful to define this parameter. Epsilon is minus h dot over h squared. That's not. So in single field slow roll inflation, I defined epsilon to be, I took this to be the definition of epsilon. I defined it in terms of derivatives of the potential. But if you use your expansion of various things in slow roll parameters, you'll see that this is also equal to epsilon, this in only to leading order. And so at least if I'm just working to leading order, this is also a perfectly fine definition of epsilon that generalizes from the single field slow roll case to this more general setting. It'll be small. In terms of the parameters, it turns out to be, let me write a formula for it that I'm going to use later. I'll say define. And this always turns out to be much less than one. This is the same statement that as saying that W is close to minus one. Okay. Now let's start talking about fluctuations. So I want to expand the action around. I've told you some properties of the background. I want to expand the action and powers of fluctuations are in the background. So I want to. Oh, one important point. So I'm going to. For purposes of analyzing the two-point function and three-point function, treat this model as if it was I'm going to expand in fluctuations in phi. So I'll take phi to be some background solution. Plus some, so little phi is going to represent the fluctuation with a non-dynamical metric. I won't go through the type of analysis that is in the Maldacena paper, where you keep track of both fluctuations in phi and the metric, and then you have to choose a gauge, and you get all these new nonlinear terms. So if you do this, this is a much simpler procedure. If you do this procedure for single field slow roll inflation, what will happen is that you'll get the two-point function correct, but the three-point function wrong, but only by terms of order the slow roll parameters. Now, in the single field slow roll case, the whole three-point function is of order the slow roll parameters. So this is not an okay approximation for studying the three-point function. But what will happen here, where we'll eventually get a large three-point function, is that the terms that you miss when you make this approximation are subleading. Hopefully we'll have time to talk about the effective field theory of inflation, which that formalism will contain a nice way of seeing that these statements are true. Okay. So if I expand on these fluctuations, the action will consist of terms with 0, 1, 2, 3, and 4 powers of the fluctuations. I don't need to calculate the first two terms. I know that terms that are zeroth order in the fluctuations don't affect anything. And that I know that terms which are first order in the fluctuations will be 0, maybe after doing some integrations by parts, because I'm expanding around a background which solves the equations of motion. So I'll just start with S2. The quadratic part will tell me what the two-point function is. So to expand that, first let me note that the quantity delta mu phi squared. So if I expand around the background, which depends on t but not x, then that will have a, this four vector will have a non-zero zero component in the background. So I'll get this guy at zeroth order in the fluctuations, this at first order, and then I'll write the second order term like this. If I expand S2, I now get the following terms. So if I expand the normal kinetic term to second order in the fluctuations, I get this. The potential, you know, I would write the potential as V plus V prime times delta phi minus 1/2 plus 1/2 V double prime delta phi and so on. And get this. And then in the new term, if I square this and keep the second order piece, I get a term where I have two powers of the first order piece, and then terms where I have the zeroth order piece times the second order piece, which gives this. So I'm going to ignore the V double prime for now, but and justify that approximation at the end. Let's keep you down here. Okay. So I have this term that contains little phi dot squared with no accompanying spatial derivatives. So one thing that's interesting about this quadratic action that differs from the types of actions we were getting before is that the coefficients of the term with time-time derivatives and the term with space-based derivatives are different. If I separate out the time and space pieces explicitly, here's what I get. In general, if you have an action where the coefficient of phi dot squared is different from the coefficient of d phi squared, what that means is that fluctuations propagate at less than the speed of light. So if I define a sound speed, one over cs squared to be the ratio of these two coefficients. Then this is, I guess, the phase velocity of the phi fluctuations. The dispersion relation of the phi fluctuations is this. And that can happen even though the underlying action itself is Lorentz invariant because I'm expanding around a background which is breaking the Lorentz symmetry. It's varying in time but not space. So in terms of that action, if I I'm going to rewrite the action just to make the coefficients look nicer. I'll rewrite the action where I convert this to a 1 over cs squared times this. And then in this step, I'm also going to recognize this factor that's sitting in front of the space-based derivative as a factor that appeared over here in my calculation of epsilon. So the action can be a nice way of writing the various coefficients in the action is like this. Epsilon over phi dot squared times 1 over cs squared phi dot minus 1 half e to the minus 2 tau. Okay. So I'm starting to organize the action in terms of quantities that I, with factors that I can think about a little more physically. Now is also a good time to switch change variables from phi to zeta. So zeta ends up being the observable in the end. And from our discussion of single field inflation, zeta turned out to be equal to, if I ask, given a phi fluctuation, how much does, on a non-dynamical metric, how much would an observer sees a phi fluctuation as meaning that the metric, the scale factor is lagging behind the value of phi. If the observer reverses the question and asks, how much would the universe expand in the time that it takes to catch up, that's zeta. And so that's sort of a physical argument that zeta is always equal to this. And this is generally true in any single field model of inflation. It's not that argument's not didn't use any properties of the action of single field slow roll. It just assumed that there was one clock. So if I make that change of variables, then I can write the action this way. So and let's see. While I'm at it, I'll do a couple other things. I'll switch to conformal time, and I'll just write the action in Fourier space. So let's see. So in conformal time, the a becomes a squared. This prefactor, when I put in the phi dot squared over h squared, just becomes 2m Planck squared epsilon. And then in the brackets here, 1 over cs squared phi prime minus k squared So this looks just like the action that we had before in single field slow roll, except for this 1 over cs squared is new. Now, the 1 over cs squared is kind of annoying because you have to revisit. So we know that if we calculate, for example, the two-point function, oh, sorry, this should have been zeta, but phi, this needs to be zeta. Yeah, thanks. I noticed that. I noticed that too. Oh, yeah. I'm a machine at forgetting factors of two. Okay. So this action looks exactly like the action of single field slow roll inflation after you change variables to zeta, including the factor of 2m Planck squared, this precise prefactor. The thing that's new is the 1 over cs squared. By the way, in the regime that we're considering, this factor of 1 over cs squared, so these terms are dominating. And so this goes to 3. The sound speed is about 1 over square root 3. In our slow roll regime. Okay, so now we know because we've seen this action before that if CS were equal to 1, that the solution to this free quantum field theory, let me put I superscripts because this will, I'm really talking about the interaction picture here. So we know because we studied this before that the solution will look something like this, where the mode functions look like h over 2 k to the 3 halves 1 plus I k tau. If I were into sitter anyway, they would look like this. The question is, where do the CSs go now that I have a CS in the action? And so if we You know, what'll generally happen in this type of situation is that you need to kind of revisit the calculation, which is kind of annoying to figure out where the CSs end up. So it turns out to be true that, you know, what you get in this case is you end up with a CS to the 1 half here and CSs here. Let me just show you how the CSifying of expressions that we have had before works. I'm going to do one calculation where I go through the details. So if this were my action, then the first step in solving this quadratic action is to canonically normalize. Okay, so let's show this is true. Canonically normalize. So we have to define a canonically normalized field sigma, which we just read off by seeing what prefactor will make the coefficient of sigma prime squared equal to 1 half. And that factor is I made life difficult for myself by doing this. Made life difficult for myself in my notes, but that's okay. And so that factor is 2 epsilon to the 1/2 M Planck CS to the minus 1 zeta. Okay, now if I go through the action with an A. Okay. If I make that change to variables, there's an integration by parts step here that always happens. I get sigma prime squared minus the CS moves here, but not now the equation of motion. If I use VK, to denote mode functions for the sigma field, then the equation of motion that they satisfy is this. So the V is the variable where the equation of motion just looks like V double prime plus omega V equals zero, a harmonic oscillator, but with a time-dependent omega. And now I now I argued that very early on, when we talked about this type of time-dependent action, that the normalization that you want to use is in a situation where omega becomes constant at early times, which is the case here. The omega, oh, this should be CS squared. So at early times, omega becomes CS times K. That the correct early time normalization to correspond to the ground state of the oscillator is, it just depends on the omega. So it doesn't matter here that CS and K are different quantities. It's just the product CSK that matters. The correct early time normalization is just 1 over 2 omega to the 1/2 times e to the I omega t, where omega is just the square root of whatever sitting here. Okay. So the solution, if we compare this to what we had before, without the CSs, we found that the solution to the equation of motion was this. If we look at what we have now, we'll see, you see that all that we did is just replace in this canonically normalized field. All that we did is just replace K by CSK everywhere, everywhere in the initial conditions and everywhere in the equation of motion. So it follows that if we just doctor this up by putting CSs, replacing K everywhere by CSK, that it will be the solution, and that's easy to check. Yeah, okay. Now to go back to you. When I go back to you, I just put in zeta is related to sigma by putting in these factors. And so that gives me, oh, I forgot the M Planck here. I tend to forget the M Planck because I'm kind of inconsistent about when I set M Planck to 1. So if I put in these factors, remembering that A is minus 1 over H tau into sitter, then I get an overall factor of I, which never matters in the end, since when we compute correlation functions, we always have equal numbers of u's and u stars, times 1 plus I CSK tau e to the minus I CSK tau. So you have to go through all this algebra to see that, to CSify this mode function, you end up replacing K everywhere by KCS, except for in this denominator where instead of, if you just replace K everywhere by CSK, you would predict CS to the 3/2 here, and it actually comes out CS to the 1/2 when you go through all the steps. Okay. In particular, let me put it in this corner. So we found the mode function, and in particular, we've now computed the power spectrum at late times. If we were to compute the correlator of two zetas, that would just be by Wick's theorem, one factor of u at time 0 times one factor of u star at time 0, which is h squared over 4 m Planck squared CS is 1 over k cubed times epsilon. So in this model, the power spectrum, the epsilon is always here, but in this model, the scalar fluctuations are enhanced by another parametric factor of 1 over CS. The tensors are still going to be, are still going to have power spectrum h squared over m Planck squared, because the scalar field and its interactions don't matter in the gravity wave sector. The gravity wave sector still has the same action. So the tensor to scalar ratio, which we think of as being the observable quantity, is suppressed by a factor of CS in this type of model. Okay. Next, I'm going to calculate the 3-point function, but I guess that's going to have to be tomorrow.